From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump, while in Japan during his first stop of his Asia tour, spoke to troops at Yokota Air Base. The U.S. will never yield, waver, or falter in defense of the American people and their freedom, he said. His remarks came at the start of a nearly two-week Asian trip.
No one, no dictator, no regime, and no nation should underestimate ever American resolve. Every once in a while in the past, they underestimated us. It was not pleasant for them, was it? It was not pleasant.
He was later greeted by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He also indicated he is expected to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the APEC meeting. Saudi Arabia's state media says it has intercepted a ballistic missile fired from Yemen aimed at the King Khalid International Airport northeast of Riyadh. Iran-backed Houthi fighters in Yemen have claimed responsibility for the missile, which was intercepted by Saudi forces. Saudi authorities said it caused no casualties or major damage. The Houthis said they were targeting the airport. Here in the United States, by a wide margin, U.S. voters are continuing to disapprove of President Donald Trump's performance in office. In the latest national survey, The Washington Post and ABC News said that 59% of Americans disapprove of the job that Mr. Trump is doing in the White House, 37% approve. He was elected a year ago this week and assumed power in January. The newspaper said Mr. Trump's approval rating is lower than any previous chief executive at this point in his presidency, over seven decades of polling. This is VOA News.
In the presence of their lawyers, they were officially notified of the European arrest warrants. In compliance with the Belgian procedure, the Brussels prosecutor's office will seize an investigative judge in order to execute the European arrest warrants.
That is Gilles Dejamep, a spokesperson for the Belgian prosecutor's office, speaking on the arrest of Catalonia's ousted leader, Carles Puigdemont, and four former ministers who turned themselves in Sunday. Catalonia's ousted leader and the four ministers were wanted following Spain's issuance of a warrant for their arrest. Dejamep, during a news conference, discussed what's next.
The investigative judge has to decide within 24 hours, which means that a decision has to be made no later than 9:17 tomorrow morning.
A Spanish judge issued the warrant for Puigdemont the day after she jailed nine members of the region's separatist government pending possible charges over last week's Declaration of Independence. One person was later granted bail.
You just heard Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon.
Resigning.
He said basically Hezbollah took over, which means Iran took over. And I think this is a wake-up call for everyone.
That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking on BBC's Andrew Marr show. He said the resignation of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saeed al-Hariri was a wake-up call to Iran's ultimate plans.
As ISIS moves out, Iran moves in. But they want to bring their air force there, right next to Israel. They want to bring Shiite and Iranian divisions right next to Israel. They want to bring submarines and military vessels right into the Mediterranean, right next to Israel. So we will not let that happen. We will resist it.
Hundreds of protesters were arrested in Moscow Sunday during a demonstration against Russian President Vladimir Putin, coinciding with celebrations of Russia's National Unity Day. According to OVD Info, which monitors crackdowns on demonstrations, 360 people had been arrested in demonstrations across the country by 5 p.m. Sunday. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says it has discovered several cases of fraud committed during the height of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa from the years 2014 to 2016. In a statement, the aid agency said it is outraged by the discovery and said it would ensure any staff involved are held to account. The outbreak killed more than 11,000 people, infected another 29,000, and cost more than $6 million during its height when it ravaged the countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castillo. On February 11, 2016, a group of excited scientists held a press conference here in Washington, D.C. What they had to say rocked the scientific community. Researchers with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, a consortium of the California Institute of Technology and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, announced they observed gravitational waves for the first time. Gravitational waves are described as ripples or waves in the fabric of space-time, the interconnection of space and time. According to the scientists, gravitational waves are caused by some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. In this case, it was the violent collision and merger of two black holes some 1.3 billion light-years away. The announcement of the scientific breakthrough took place a little over 100 years after the brilliant Albert Einstein predicted their existence in his general theory of relativity. From that point until August 17th of this year, the scientists reported three additional detections of gravitational waves, all produced by the explosive merger of black holes. Not only did scientists make their fifth detection of gravitational waves on August 17th, but they also learned that the waves were produced by the collision and merger of two neutron stars, which are the smallest but most dense stars known to exist in the universe. This time around, along with detecting the gravitational waves, thousands of scientists, including today's guests, working at a number of facilities around the world, were actually able to observe in visible light the cosmic event that produced them. Since the science behind this breakthrough is so sophisticated and intense, I've invited my guests to help us get a better understanding of this discovery and why the science community considers it to be one of the most significant advancements in years. Joining me today are Anthony Pirro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatory's Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Shappi. He's an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. Ben, first to you. There had been four detections of gravitational waves prior to the August 17th event. Why was this detection of gravitational waves so special in the scientific community?
All the previous ones have been the merger of black holes, and they're very exciting and interesting by themselves, but they're much more massive than what we saw here. What we saw here was actually two neutron stars merging. So if you merge two black holes, you expect to create another black hole, and there's very little expectation that you should see any signature other than gravity. You shouldn't see any light emitted. But if you merge two neutron stars, the expectation for a long time has been that you should be able to see those in other messengers, in other ways. So you should actually be able to look with optical telescopes and see that event after it merges. And then you should be able to learn more about the physics and what's going on of that merger by being able to study it in multiple ways.
Tony, could you give us lay people understanding what is a neutron star? How are they produced? And how common is it for two neutron stars to get attracted to each other enough to orbit each other and then collide?
So neutron stars are some of the most amazing stars you could ever imagine. So these are the dense cores of massive stars, much more than 10, 20 times the mass of our sun. When they die, they leave these cores. And a neutron star core, it's something like 1.5 times the mass of our sun, but the actual radius is only about 10 kilometers, so about the size of a city. And so you're just packing all this mass into this tiny compact object. And just to give you an idea of what kind of density do you have here, this is the same density. If you took one sugar cube of a neutron star, this would have the same mass as all the humans on Earth packed together. And this is the kind of extreme type of star you need to produce these gravitational waves. Getting to your other question about the neutron stars and these binaries. So we actually have eight of these neutron star binaries that we know about in our own galaxy. And we see these things slowly merging due to the emission of gravitational waves. But it's going to take hundreds of millions of years for these to merge, so we can't actually see these with our gravitational wave detectors. But we can actually look at neutron stars when they're getting even closer to each other, right in the moments when they actually merge in far-off galaxies like we did here. And a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, we think these happen every 50,000 years or so, which may sound like a long time, but in terms of astronomical times or length scales, that's actually pretty common.
This particular discovery was incredible. There were so many scientists, so many institutions involved with this discovery. Astronomical facilities around the world were involved in this discovery. Ben, could you give us a little bit of an outline of how extensive the science community was involved in this finding?
Absolutely. This was probably one of the biggest astronomical efforts on any single study yet undertaken. For the gravitational waves, you really only detect the source with LIGO and Virgo. So at that stage, they're the only players. And then less than 2 seconds after these two neutron stars that Tony just described merged, there was a strong gamma ray burst. Gamma rays are just the same as photons that you see with your eye, but they're much higher energy. They're so high energy they can't go through the atmosphere, so you have to go to space to detect them. Those were detected with the Fermi Space Telescope, also Integral, which is another space telescope. So now, less than 2 seconds after merger, we already have LIGO, Virgo, and two space telescopes. They got together and realized what was going on. They put out an alert to the community. And then basically anybody who studies transients, so changing objects on the sky, everybody was interested in this. So anybody who could try to look for this. Chile was the first place this part of the sky was visible. So there's a huge number of people who searched for the object right away. The group that Tony and I are involved with were the ones who discovered it first. But then after we alerted the community that we found a potential optical counterpart, basically anybody with a telescope on the ground tried to observe it. Swift Space Telescope immediately was also searching for it and also followed it up afterwards. It's a UV X-ray telescope. Chandra observed it. Hubble Space Telescope observed it. So basically, any telescope that could point at it, pointed at it, including radio like VLA, which is a big radio telescope in New Mexico. If you've seen Contact, that's one of the telescopes there. So basically anything that could did look at this.
What I'm impressed with is the magnitude of involvement by the scientific community in this discovery. I mean, this logistically had to be a real difficult thing for everyone to put their resources together and join together to make this discovery. Tony, your thoughts about that?
Well, I think a part of it just speaks to the magnitude of the discovery, that everyone wanted to coordinate and work together like they did. I'm just taking Carnegie Observatories as an example. So we have a number of telescopes on the mountain range where we work. We have the two Magellan telescopes that Ben was mentioning, the 6.5 meters. We have the DuPont telescope, a 2-meter telescope, and the Swope telescope. And so even after we discovered the counterpart, over the following 3 weeks, we had to coordinate all sorts of efforts amongst the different telescopes, trying to find people that would help us follow it up, try to get different types of data so we could investigate this object as well as we could. But everyone knew, understood the magnitude of the discovery. And so we didn't get a lot of pushback when we were trying to involve more people and trying to coordinate things. It was really a testament to, you know, everyone working together and trying to get the most science done possible, which just made an incredibly exciting experience.
How do you know where to look in the sky to observe the event that caused these gravitational waves, Ben?
We've taken a step back just slightly. So a gravitational wave is basically a stretching of space by a very small amount. So these are huge detectors. They stretch a couple kilometers, a couple miles long, and they're looking for a change in distance that is much smaller than an atom and even smaller than a proton, which is a part of an atom. And so it's very hard to do. And so the reason you need multiple detectors is to actually get information about where it's coming from. So one thing that you can do is just like GPS works, there's a time delay, so light travels at a certain speed, so do gravitational waves, and which detector they hit first, you can get information about what direction they're coming from. Another thing that you can do is that just by the properties of these gravitational waves, they actually affect the distance in different directions slightly differently as they pass. And so then the multiple detectors can actually get some information on direction as well by how strong of a signature that they see in each arm of each detector.
These gravitational waves, they were predicted over 100 years ago by Albert Einstein in his general theory of relativity. I hear them being described as ripples in the fabric of space-time, and that sounds rather poetic, but what does that really mean?
It literally means that as these stars are merging, they're sending out ripples that you could imagine, like ripples on the surface of a pond. But instead of being ripples of water, they're actually ripples in space-time, where length scales are actually getting longer and shorter as these ripples pass by. And if you had a clock, the clock would actually be going faster and slower. It's just incredible that you actually have these ripples in space-time themselves that are traveling by.
Tony, since you headed up the Carnegie team on this discovery, do you have any stories you can share with us as far as what it was like when you first took a peek in visible light at the event that caused this gravitational wave?
So when we first discovered it, it was just pretty incredible because we didn't know what it was going to look like. There had been a lot of theoretical expectations worked out in the past trying to understand what this would be, but it ended up being this bright blue source on the galaxy that just looked beautiful, like this blue diamond shining on this galaxy. And so it was just pretty breathtaking to know that we were the first people witnessing these photons coming from a gravitational wave source like this. Ben was actually on the mountain the night when it was discovered. What kind of excitement it was for him to be rushing around trying to find this elusive source in the sky.
Absolutely. So I was on the mountain at Las Campanas, and I had two nights on Magellan. And so for astronomers, time on a telescope is very precious. You have to apply for it, you know, months in advance, and you have to specify exactly what you want to observe, and you have a big plan. Everything has to be really carefully laid out. And actually, another side story is what's funny on that night is I was actually going to study Assassin 15LH, which is the most luminous supernova ever discovered, which I discussed with you last time I was on. So that's actually the object I was supposed to be observing that night. When I woke up, my email was just full of emails from a lot of collaborators basically saying that there was this detection. Like, you wake up in the afternoon, and then right then there was this, you know, this scramble. I have to figure out exactly what's going on and figure out what I can do to, you know, try to help this, you know, discovery. And then I realized that I was on one Magellan. Josh Simon, another Carnegie astronomer, was on the other Magellan telescope. And we also had SWOPE to search with as well. And so we had three really good telescopes to search for this event. And so we're in a perfect position to try to, you know, map out every galaxy where it could have been in very quickly. And so, you know, I skipped dinner. I contacted the director of the observatory to say, can I switch the programs? You know, what can we do? And basically, I was told that, you know, just throw his name around, get whatever I need to search for this object, do whatever it takes. And so at that point, we organized ourselves, and it was just this frantic rush of organizing exactly what you want to do. On that night, I actually had two graduate students with me and one undergraduate to basically learn how to use Magellan and how to observe. And so I just kept repeating myself to them on this frantic way of trying to organize the night. I said, basically, everything that you see here is not what you should be doing. Everything on a big telescope should be boring. It should never be exciting because you want to have, you know, just planned out ABC. And so a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz actually gave us a list of galaxies. He wrote before this event happened, this computer program, to figure out exactly what was the most efficient way of tiling a particular part of the sky to get all of the galaxies. And so then just 15 minutes before nighttime, he gave us these lists of galaxies that were prioritized for each telescope. So on my telescope, we were searching in the infrared, so redder wavelengths than you can see. From SWOPE, we were searching basically in the optical, but really red light. And then from Josh Simon on the other Magellan was searching in blue. And so we started searching very frantically all of the galaxies. And just 15 minutes in, I get an email from Charlie Fitzpatrick, who was just basically flipping through the images that we were taking by eye. And he says, you know, very understated way, you know, I think I found something from SWOPE. And I thought in my head, I'm like, this is way too easy. This has been searched for you know, many years, and this is just about 15 minutes into the night, we already had a candidate. And I was just like, oh, this is way too easy. Something has to be wrong. I kept searching for my telescope, and then Josh sends an email really quickly afterwards saying, oh, I'm on the same galaxy on Magellan. I see the same source. It's real. So at that point, I was like, wow, this could be real. I moved to that target as well, got infrared data on that source. Josh immediately switched to get a spectrum, which is basically kind of like if you take a prism with light and you spread it out like that Pink Floyd album, you can see the different colors. And then that allows you to get different fingerprints from the spectrum. And then the source is setting, so it's basically becoming further and further nearer the horizon, and your telescope can only point so far over. And so it was this frantic rush to get as much data as we could right before the source set. And then I was able to switch instruments again and get another spectrum with a higher resolution so you could see finer detail. Right as the source, you know, hit the hard limits of the telescope, so where the telescope just can't go down any further. And so at that point, we just basically, you know, took a breath and said, well, you couldn't observe the source anymore. And we said, wow, this really happened? Is this really the source? And then we during all this, while all this time was happening, Ryan Foley at Santa Cruz was basically writing basically a message to the entire community saying that we found something that's probably the counterpart to the gravitational wave source. And he put it out, and then we realized, you know, after the fact, after we, you know, had a couple of minutes to actually piece everything together, we realized that we were, you know, the first, you know, team to see it, the first to get data, the first to see it, the first to discover that it was the counterpart, and the first to announce it to the community and start follow-up data. And, you know, it was quite a surreal experience when we realized that we were, you know, so fortunate to be in a perfect position on all the telescopes during this event that people have been waiting for you know, decades. It was quite great.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Connect with us by email at encounter@voanews.com or check out our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA. Today we're talking about the recent scientific discovery that includes the detection of Einstein-predicted gravitational waves and the first visual observation of the explosive neutron star merger event that produced them. My guests for today's program are Anthony Puro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatories, Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Shappi, an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. Tony, this event with the two neutron stars crashing into each other and then merging has been called a kilonova. What is a kilonova?
So this term was actually penned by Ryan Metzger, who is now a professor at University of Columbia. And we were actually working together at the time when he first was working on this. And the basic idea was that as these neutron stars merge, they're going to fling out this very neutron-rich ejecta as they're ripping each other apart. And this ejecta is able to actually to synthesize different heavy elements as it's flying away from the merger site. And this stuff ends up being very radioactive and causes the ejecta to glow. And so typically when we talk about, like, transients, new types of stars, we call these novae. There's different types. There's supernovae, which are the deaths of massive stars. There's kind of typical classical novae, which are much dimmer events that are also seen from different types of stars. And because this new type of transient that Brian had been working on was right in the middle of kind of the dimmer novae and the supernovae, and they're about 1,000 times brighter than the dimmer novae, he called them kilonovae, kind of like a kilometer or something like that, the same sort of nomenclature. So it's like a supernova, but maybe 100 times or so dimmer than a normal supernova. And that just has to do with how much radioactive waste you're actually flinging away from the merger site. And so the gravity of the neutron stars is very strong. Most of the material settles down into the merger remnant. But about 1/100 of the mass of our sun or so gets flung away. And it's this amount of material that then glows with its radioactivity that we see as this kilonova.
Tony, one of the other big stories that came out of this particular discovery, not only being able to see the source of a gravitational wave, was the fact that scientists now have a better understanding of where some of the heavier elements of the universe originated. Gold, platinum, uranium, I understand, were formed as a result of events such as the kilonova.
Yeah, so you've probably heard the phrase that we are star stuff, and this comes from this idea that's been around for decades now, since like basically the 1950s, that all of the elements that we see around us are synthesized in stars or synthesized in the explosions of these stars and supernovae, which then expel all these heavy elements back up into the galaxy, form new generations of stars, eventually planets and things like us. But there's always been one missing part to that story. And that was where about half of the heavy elements come from. These are called R-process elements. They're called R-process because you need this environment where you can rapidly put neutrons together to produce heavy elements. Because neutrons, of course, don't have charge. If you pack them together fast enough, you can make nice heavy elements. Things like you mentioned gold, platinum, uranium, a lot of expensive things, europium. And so it's always been a mystery, basically, for about 70 years. What are the environments where these R-process elements are actually generated? And people have suspected neutron star mergers for a long time, but there have also been other ideas. But with this event, with the actual glowing of the kilonova that you see, based on that brightness, you can measure how bright, how much R-process material was synthesized in the ejecta, and it actually ends up being just about the right amount to explain how much of all these elements, gold and platinum, there actually is in our universe.
Ben, from what I understand, we have had gravitational waves produced by the merger of black holes and now the merger of neutron stars. Are there any other cosmological events that could cause the production of gravitational waves?
Yes, the merger of the black holes that we have seen with LIGO and Virgo, they're tens of times the mass of the sun. And as far as black holes go, they're actually pretty small. There are other black holes called supermassive black holes at the center of our own Milky Way. We can actually see direct evidence for one of these supermassive black holes at the center of our own galaxy. We've seen other evidence that they exist in basically any Milky Way-sized galaxy we look at. And we know that these Milky Way-sized galaxies merge. So that means that two of these very massive, supermassive black holes have to be present in the same galaxy after galaxies merge. But we don't see very much evidence for two in any individual galaxies. There's a couple cases. So we know that these supermassive black holes must merge together at some point. There are future missions, like the LISA mission, that are actually designed specifically to study the merger of these supermassive black holes. So these are, you know, millions to tens of millions times the mass of our own sun. The reason that LIGO and Virgo can't see it is because they can only listen to a certain frequency of gravitational wave. They can't actually hear low enough frequencies to be able to study the supermassive black hole mergers. So that's why we need to have a new mission. And we have to go to space because you need much larger distances to measure these low frequencies. And you have to get away from noise sources, such as on the Earth, the ground. Geology actually makes the whole ground rumble. So you have to go away from the Earth to actually be able to study these. These are a new and exciting future direction for gravitational wave research.
Ben, what have we learned from this discovery? If you were to encapsulate it, what would you say that was the biggest thing that we got out of this discovery?
Probably there's two big questions that were answered with this event. I think the first one is that for this decades long, we've been suspecting that this certain type of gamma ray burst comes from the merger of two neutron stars. And here we just see A and B. We see exactly what is expected. We see two neutron stars merging, and then we see the gamma ray burst. So I think that is just a completely solved question because of this discovery. I think the second part, Tony's been talking a decent amount as well, is that there's this, you know, long-standing question about where certain elements and isotopes come from on the periodic table. And now we've just seen two neutron stars merge, and then we see evidence for these isotopes, to have a slew of these isotopes. And so I think that connection is also probably one of the big major discoveries. But I think this discovery also left a bunch of questions open. So exactly how it looked like was different than theoretical expectations. And understanding why it looks a bit different will take years of effort, maybe even decades, studying this event and kind of combining all the data that was collected by many different groups and then carefully analyzing that and then building new models and refining those models to actually understand exactly what went on. I think these will be a legacy of this event as well. Just going forward, I think a lot of people, this will be an amazing data set to go and test against.
Tony, what did you take away from the discovery?
I think this really is the beginning of a new era. In the past, we've always been limited just using telescopes to learn about what's happening in the universe. And now we have these two completely different tools. We have the light that we've been using before, and we can now combine it with gravitational wave information. And together, we can learn about things that would never be possible with just one or the other. And so I just really think this is a really important moment in the history of science and how we're actually probing and learning about the universe.
Ben, Tony, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to date and helping us get a better understanding of this magnificent scientific event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation.
Great pleasure.
That was Anthony Pirro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatory's Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Chappie, an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. Thanks so much for listening. Encounter was produced at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C., and our broadcast technician was Thomas Blondet. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Anna Mateo, and Phil Dierking. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report.
For most college students, the main goal of higher education is earning a degree that will lead to a successful and satisfying career. The years spent working on a program of study can be fun and include life-changing experiences. And many college classes provide students with interesting information that they may not have even thought about before. Still, the most important thing for most students is what those years of hard work and studying can bring them once they graduate. But Jennifer Simons argues that there are many valuable things people can learn before they even attend their first college class. Simons is the director of undergraduate admissions and recruitment at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. Simons says the college application process can teach young people a lot about supporting themselves and making connections with others. In the United States, the process starts in the final 2 years of high school, when students are about 16 or 17 years old. This is the time when young people are forced to consider what happens after they leave high school. They face questions like, where do you want to go to college? And what will you study?
There are so many choices available to students that these questions can seem very difficult to answer, Simons says. So, she suggests that young people try to get a better understanding of themselves before making any decisions. Simons says that young people should start keeping a journal or written record of their ideas well before they start thinking about college. They should ask themselves questions like, who am I? What do I want out of life? And what are my strengths and weaknesses? Students should then try to write down answers to these and other questions once a day or even weekly. Also, Simons adds, they should try to take note of meaningful events that teach them something about the world or themselves. The answers to these general questions, she says, will likely give students a better understanding of how to answer more specific questions. They will have a better idea about where they might want to spend 4 years of their lives while working toward a college degree, for example. It can also give young people ideas of what to talk about in writing samples that most college applications require. In addition, she says, students who know their own strengths will better understand how to ask people they know to write letters of recommendation for them. Simons says the more young people know about themselves, the more likely they are to make decisions that will make them happy. This includes more than just decisions about college. If you understand who you are, Simons told VOA, you are less likely to fall prey to somebody else's vision for what you should be or where you should go.
Something else students can take from the application process, Simons notes, relates to how busy the process makes them. High schoolers already have their studies, personal relationships, and possibly jobs to worry about. The application process requires them to find schools that interest them, find out how to request admission, and prepare application materials. Simons argues that balancing responsibilities is one of the most important skills anyone can learn. She said, I think that you really are laying the groundwork for becoming an adult by learning how to prioritize your time. However, Simons admits that learning time management can be very difficult for young people. So learning to ask for help when you need it is another equally important lesson. School counselors, older students, and friends and family members who have attended college can all be important resources.
But with asking for help also comes thanking people once you have received it, Simons says. A simple thing young people can learn to do is sending a letter or an email thanking those who helped them get into their school of choice. Relationship building like this is important outside the college application process. Simons suggests that students should make such efforts with teachers, classmates, and anyone they meet. This can help them in the future as they look for jobs or continue their education. One final lesson students can take from the application process is accepting that their control of the situation is limited, Simons says. She points out that every college and university in the United States receives hundreds, if not thousands, of applications every year. Competition is fierce, so not everyone is going to get into their first or even second choice of school. There are many places where you could be happy, she said. I think that is human to feel like, oh, this is the perfect fit. And I feel that happens in relationships, too. But there's more than one place where you could be satisfied, and that's a good thing to know, that nothing is the only option. Simons says that accepting defeat and learning how to move past it is probably the most important lesson of all. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. In many parts of the United States, temperatures are falling. This change of season, from summer to autumn, gives Americans many things to watch. Many people travel to areas of the U.S. that are famous for autumn leaves that change into brilliant shades of red, gold, and orange. Something else to watch is the antics of squirrels. Squirrels provide some of the most interesting and entertaining behavior in the natural world. Now, I use the word antics, meaning silly or funny games, because that's what it looks like. But I am not being fair to squirrels. They are actually doing something most important, gathering and storing food for the winter months. The fact that squirrels are doing an important activity, however, makes them no less entertaining to watch. The animals hurry across the ground, digging holes to find food, or to find where they buried food. They chase each other around trees. They jump from one tree limb to another, higher and higher, up in the tree, looking for nuts and seeds. Sometimes, squirrels drop this food to the ground below, and sometimes they hit people passing by. As I said earlier, this behavior is very entertaining to watch. These woodland creatures do not stay still for very long, and they are good at collecting things. So, it is not surprising that American English has a couple of expressions with the word squirrel. First, there is the adjective squirrely. Now, squirrely has several definitions. The most common one describes someone who is unusually active and unable to sit still, much like a squirrel. Another word with the same meaning is restless. When talking about word choice, restless may be more common in everyday speech, but squirrely is much more fun. Let's hear it used in an example.
At the end of a school year, students may get a little squirrely sitting in a classroom. It's best to let them run around outside during the day.
In this example, you can almost imagine a classroom of children suddenly turning into a group of squirrels, running around and unable to sit in their seats. So, the word you use depends on the feeling you want to create in your sentence. Squirrely can also describe someone who is acting very strange or crazy. Again, like a squirrel. Finally, the adjective squirrely can describe someone or something that seems to be dishonest. A more commonly used word that means the same thing is shady. Let's hear an example.
That business deal sounds squirrely to me. If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
So that is the adjective. We also have a very useful expression from the world of squirrels. To squirrel something away. Okay, so we know that squirrels collect nuts, seeds, and other things to eat. Then they hide them away to survive winter weather, when food is hard to find. People can do the same thing. When we squirrel something away, we put something in a safe or secret place so that we can use it in the future. When we collect or save things in an unusual or even unhealthy way, you could use the word hoard. Here's another example.
She has squirreled away magazines for years. There are stacks and stacks in her attic. I'm not sure what she is saving them for, but she won't get rid of them.
The things people squirrel away usually aren't nuts and seeds. We most often squirrel away money for the future.
When he retired, he was able to live quite comfortably. He squirreled away over $400,000 in the bank.
But we can squirrel away anything that is important to us and that we want to use later.
She squirreled away her favorite color of wool yarn as if they weren't going to make it anymore. She has more than 30 rolls of it in her closet.
And that's Words and Their Stories for today. But we'll be back next week. It's my custom to squirrel away story ideas for this program, so we'll have a new one then. I'm Anna Mateo.
What if you could wave your phone over a piece of fish at a store and immediately see a record of its path through the supply chain? This may soon be possible. Current experiments are testing technology that can show how the fish was caught, when it was shipped, and how it was processed at a factory. This technology, called blockchain, is being tested for its potential to bring light to secretive industries in Southeast Asia. Blockchain was first developed to confirm dealings in Bitcoin, a digital money. In that case, the technology creates a public financial record. In Southeast Asia, important records, including those of identity information and property ownership, are often not carefully kept. Aaron Murphy is the founder and leader of Inlay Advisory Group, a business advisory company working in Myanmar and other countries with developing markets. She said blockchain technology helps make business operations in such countries safer and easier. Ideally, we would want to see adoption of blockchain at an official level all across the region. But perhaps not surprisingly, the governments that are leading blockchain adoption are those that are already low corruption, she told VOA. In some countries like Singapore, Murphy said blockchain is being used to improve customer service processes. However, in other countries, like the Philippines, blockchain helps citizens safely send money home from foreign countries. Murphy said the technology will help development, lower poverty, and increase foreign investment. Right now, there are many programs in Southeast Asia experimenting with blockchain technology. In June, the United Nations presented a blockchain-based system built in partnership with the technology company Microsoft and professional services company Accenture. The system gives stateless refugees a permanent identity record based on biometric data. The technology is also being explored in connection with efforts to improve voting system security. A blockchain-based app developed to observe the supply chain of fish from Indonesia is now being used with other industries, including clothing. Results from a pilot project can be found on the internet. Viewers can observe the movement of a piece of clothing from an alpaca farm in Dulverton, Britain, through every step of production to its final stop at a shop in London. Elisa DiCaprio is the head of research at R3, a banking software company that uses technology similar to blockchain. She said getting the technology and being able to use it are separate issues. Most countries have engineers who can rightly code the technology, she said. However, they do not always understand how to make it work for businesses and industries. DiCaprio predicts it will take about 5 years before we actually see blockchain used widely. She said she believes the most important effects of the technology will be seen on a macroeconomic level. However, the blockchain community is divided on how the technology should be used. Some see blockchain as a tool that can interfere with a global financial system they believe is corrupt. There is a serious opportunity for us here to remove money out of government, said a Southeast Asia-based Bitcoin trader. He said billions of people who are unable to use an official banking system will be able to move money with just a phone. Another group wants to see blockchain technology used by states such as Canada, Singapore, China, and Germany. All of these countries are exploring or experimenting with digital money using blockchain. Michael Shea is with the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. He suggested that blockchain creates a threat for government only if they ignore the technology. Countries that use it to establish safe and honest systems for money exchange will appeal to business and investment interests, he said. I'm Phil Dierking.
The state of Utah is home to five major national parks. They are among the most famous parks in the United States. This week, our national parks journey brings us to the southeastern part of the state. Here, you will find narrow canyons, steep cliffs, and hidden river valleys. Welcome to Zion National Park.
Zion sits within a desert landscape. The 260-kilometer-long Virgin River runs through it. It provides water for more than 1,000 kinds of plants to grow and over 100 kinds of animals to live, including the desert tortoise, desert bighorn sheep, and mountain lions. River water has also carved out the area's spectacular canyons and gorges. One of them, called Zion Canyon, stretches more than 20 kilometers through the park. In some places, it is more than 600 meters deep. At its most narrow point, it is just 6 meters across. Zion is one of the 10 most visited parks in the country. Travelers from America and around the world come here to explore its canyons, climb its steep walls, and walk its dramatic trails.
Zion's extraordinary beauty affected early Mormon settlers. Members of the religious group came to the area beginning in the 1850s. They thought it looked like heaven. They named the land after a place from the Bible, Zion. Zion means sanctuary or refuge in ancient Hebrew. Mormons were not, of course, the first people to explore the area. Experts say humans first arrived around 12,000 years ago. They hunted very large animals, like mammoths, giant sloths, and camels. Climate change and overhunting caused these animals to die out about 8,000 years ago. Humans changed their methods. They hunted smaller animals and gathered other food. Some 2,000 years ago, a culture centered on what we now call Zion began to form. Scientists know these people as the Virgin Anasazi. They settled in the area and grew crops. They used the water from the Virgin River and depended on the rich diversity of native plants and animals. Over time, many Native American groups called the area home, including the Southern Paiute. The Southern Paiutes called the area Makuntuweap. In their language, the name meant Straight Canyon. The United States Congress moved to protect the area beginning in the early 1900s. In 1909, it became a national monument. It was called Makuntuweap National Monument. President William Taft established the national monument. He described the land as a labyrinth of remarkable canyons with highly ornate and beautifully colored walls, in which are plainly recorded the geological events of past ages. In 1918, the National Monument became a national park. And in 1919, Congress changed its name to Zion, the name used by the Mormons.
Today, almost 3 million people visit Zion National Park each year. Driving is restricted in much of the park during busy months. Instead, visitors travel in small buses that take them to areas where they can walk on paths into the wild areas. Walking is the best way to explore Zion. The park offers visitors many different kinds of paths. Some are short and easy. One easy walk is almost 2 kilometers. It takes hikers to a clear pool of water and waterfalls. Other hikes take most people all day to complete. Some are not advisable for people who are afraid of high places. A hike called Angel's Landing is considered one of the most exciting hikes in America. The trail leads to the top of a rock formation that stands more than 450 meters above the canyon floor. Toward the top of the rock, the walking path becomes extremely narrow. On both sides are very steep cliffs. Hikers can hold on to a rope for increased safety. Most hikers say the views from Angel's Landing make the difficult and dangerous experience worth it. Some visitors favor the lower parts of Zion National Park. One popular area is known as the Narrows. The Narrows is the narrowest part of Zion Canyon. The area has extremely tall canyon walls and unusual hanging gardens. These green areas of wildflowers, ferns, and mosses grow out of the sandstone walls. If you want to explore the Narrows, you must be ready to get wet. Hiking in the Narrows means walking next to, and even in, the Virgin River. If water levels are high, walking in the river can be extremely difficult. Sometimes, hikers may be waist-high in water.
Even near the canyon floor, hikes at Zion can be dangerous. The great amount of rock in the area does not absorb water. As a result, sudden floods, called flash floods, are a serious threat. People can help prepare themselves as much as possible for the dangers of Zion National Park at the Visitor Center. But the risks come with great rewards. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.